All right, Mr. Venezia, is that right? Okay. Two of you have been patiently waiting. You've learned all about criminal conspiracy, usufruct, and ERISA. So you're armed and ready.
A very interesting morning, Your Honor.
All right, go ahead.
May it please the court, my name is John Venezia, and I represent Johnny Thornton, who is a plaintiff in a lawsuit, a civil rights lawsuit he filed against Sergeant Corey Limus of the New Orleans Police Department. My client's case was dismissed by the district court on a Rule 12b6 motion to dismiss, and we're here appealing that ruling, believing that it was an error. As the court, I'm sure, well knows, that in a Rule 12b6 motion, both the lower court and this court have to assume all the facts pled in my client's petition are true, all well-pled facts. All inferences of fact must be resolved in favor of the non-mover, which was my client. This court has the ability to review the lower court's ruling de novo, and there's no ambiguity or question about the standard of review, unlike some of the earlier cases Your Honor's dealt with. Now, my client's complaint, the active complaint, alleges that Mr. Limus, or Sergeant Limus, went and obtained an arrest warrant for my client. In the arrest warrant, he alleged that three juvenile detainees at the jail where my client worked alleged that those detainees accused my clients of committing acts of violence on them. His affidavit, in addition to detaining those allegations, included a false statement. False statement was that the video that captured one of the incidents showed that my clients had a motion that was consistent with a jab punch. The video does not show that my client's motions was consistent with a jab punch, making that allegation false. Also in that affidavit, Sergeant Lima stated that he believed that there was probable cause for my arrest when he gave statements to my client contrary to that. He told my client that he did not believe there was probable cause for an arrest, and he was doing it because his boss told him to. In addition to those two false statements that were in Sergeant Limus' affidavit, there was also a lot of exculpatory evidence that Sergeant Limus was aware of that he omitted from the affidavit. He omitted that Mr. Thornton, my client, was a witness against one of these juveniles who had attempted to escape prior to these alleged acts of violence. That several months before that, the juvenile had tried to escape the jail facility, and my client, along with the other people that worked there, caught him. So that gave this accuser an additional grounds to lie about what my client did. That information was not included in the affidavit. That accuser, as well as the other two accusers, had very violent and criminal histories, and those facts were not made known to the magistrate when he filled out his affidavit. The video of both the first incident, which showed some of the actual melee, and then the later two incidents, which were to show my client carrying the accusers into their cells, and you couldn't see what occurred in the cells. Those videos showed a whole bunch of other jail employees who were physically present and could see what happened, including what happened in the cell, because it shows them going into the cell with them. All of those other jail employees gave written statements to Sergeant contemporaneous that were written contemporaneous with the events that Sergeant Limus had that said my client was innocent. He did not relate to the magistrate judge that those people that gave exculpatory statements, that they were confirmed, their ability to observe what occurred was confirmed by the videotape. Sergeant Limus did not include that the accuser's injuries could have come, or likely did come, from prior altercations that they had. My client did have to put force on these individuals in the jail because they were all engaged in acts of violence with other people, some with other jail employees when one of them tried to throw bleach into the eyes of one of the female employees. Other times, the other two were in fist fights with other detainees, and my client had to restrain them in order to protect the other detainees from injury. Those acts of violence were sources of injuries that were not related to the magistrate judge. One of the accusers claimed that my client, very audaciously, pinned him down and tried to grab his penis, or did grab his penis, six times. One, on its face, that's not very plausible because it was done with a whole bunch of other adults around, and That's just a very, very bizarre thing for someone to accuse him of doing right there in the open with all these other witnesses around. But that juvenile, before he was gave the statement to Sergeant Limus, had gone to the hospital. And he didn't tell the doctors at the hospital that that is what happened to him. So there was an inconsistency between what was in his medical records and what he told Sergeant Limus. That inconsistency was not made known to the magistrate, although it was known to Sergeant Limus. One of the detainees claimed that he was playing around with the other guards when Mr. Thornton had to come and restrain him. Well, the video shows him taking a cup of bleach and throwing it at the other people's eyes. That's not playing around, and it's obvious from the video. So he gave an inconsistent statement. That particular juvenile gave an inconsistent statement about what he was doing. That inconsistency was not presented to the magistrate. Sergeant Limus and the other officers who investigated this matter did not believe that Mr. Thornton was guilty, did not believe that there was probable cause. Sergeant Limus said this to Mr. Thornton. That their beliefs about what these experienced officers' beliefs about what they observed and learned about with these incidents was not related to the magistrate judge. The fact that the only reason that Sergeant Limus chose to arrest my client or to seek this warrant to arrest my client was because his boss told him to, that fact was not included in the affidavit. We believe the omissions of all this very important information, as well as the inclusion of the false information, amounts to a Franks case. The Supreme Court in Franks versus Delaware said that a warrant that was based upon an affidavit containing false information was invalid. The progeny have often said, particularly I point out Winford versus Rogers, said that, failure to include or omitting exculpatory evidence can be the basis for a Franks claim in a civil rights action like my client is pursuing. Now, in Winfrey versus Rogers, this court reversed a lower court's granting of a summary judgment when the officer failed to include in his affidavit inconsistent statements made by the accuser and forensic evidence that tended to show that the plaintiff in that case was not guilty or not worthy of being arrested. Neither the inconsistent statement nor the forensic evidence made that particular plaintiff absolutely certainly innocent. There is still the remote possibility that he was in fact guilty of the crime. Nonetheless, this court says that still wasn't sufficient to establish probable cause. The omissions don't have to rise to like DNA evidence and have to rise to the standard where we know for certain that the plaintiff is absolutely innocent in order for there to be a Franks claim against the officer who omitted the appropriate evidence from the affidavit. And I think that is what you have here. You have an officer that in repetitive instances in lots of different ways omitted exculpatory evidence and included false evidence in his affidavit to get a warrant to arrest my client, and it was done so improperly, particularly in this case where his motive was doing so was to make his boss happy.
So, counsel, just to clarify, the false evidence you say was included in the affidavit is really the affiant's opinion about what the video showed, right? In other words, it's consistent with a jab punch.
Yes, but there's some things, you say opinion.
Yeah, I mean, how is that a fact?
Because a jab punch is going to require the use of my arms. In the video, my client's arms are occupied restraining the defendant, his upper body, while other people are holding the defendant, the accuser's legs. So that Mr. Sexton was the gentleman's name that they were restraining. So his arms are accounted for. So the video, I mean, you're right. Some things could be an opinion on a video, like whether that's a different shade of brown. We might have to argue about what different shades of brown that might be. But the fact that it's brown is not going to be a difference. There's not going to be something subject to debate. Since my client's arms were occupied throughout the entire time, there's nothing in it that any reasonable person could see to reach the conclusion that it was a jab, that his movements was consistent with a jab punch.
What about the district court's conclusion, though, that if you remove that, there was still probable cause?
Well, the district court's conclusion is their conclusion, but it's not one that you are bound to at all. This is not a jury trial. This is not even a summary judgment grant. This is not an ERISA trial. This is just her reading the cold record and coming to this conclusion that I disagree with. And your honors are free, are not restrained in any way, or do not have to give deference to the lower court's decision in any way, shape, or form.
Counsel, to frame the Franks issue, we have to remove from the, set aside the false statements that were made, and then ask the question of whether there's probable cause. And take away the statements, misstatements, the inaccuracies there. The question is, does probable cause remain? You still have a picture of a very heavy treatment of a detainee, et cetera, et cetera. But that's the framing the issue. That's their question. Take away those, then what's left?
It is, but it's more than just taking away the false statements. You also have to add in all the exculpatory statements. And there's plenty of exculpatory statements. There's no mention whatsoever in the affidavit of Mr. Stexon's very specific motivation to lie because my client caught him escaping 2 months before. That's a clear motive for that juvenile to lie about my client, and it wasn't contained in the affidavit. Their criminal histories were not contained in the affidavit. Other things...
Criminal history is exculpatory. I mean, that by virtue of the fact that they were in the juvenile detention, you could say they've got a criminal history, but that doesn't mean that they... basically can't be victims of a separate crime.
It doesn't, but it's a factor. I mean, the rules of evidence say that a person has a conviction, that alone can be a reason to find them incredible. That's true in our law going back probably centuries.
Probable cause stage?
It's still a factor. You still would have to list a reliability of an informant in a criminal affidavit. You still have to say he's got prior, an officer's required to say that he's got prior criminal histories. When someone gives... he's an informant for an affidavit for a wiretap or something of that other nature. That's still an issue in it. And it's particularly like when you had other people who were eyewitnesses to the events who had zero criminal histories. And another factor that I think is unique to this case is that the three individuals knew one another and were associates with one another engaged in criminal activity outside of this, before this. So getting their story straight, with Mr. Sexton, to my mind, there's absolute proof that what he was saying was not true because the videotape completely exonerates it. He said he was playing around. When he wasn't playing around, he was throwing bleach in somebody's eye. It does not show him that my client tried to do a jab punch on him. It clearly shows he did not try to do that. So, and he also said that it was my client's actions that forced him to the ground. If you look at the video, that's not what happened. It was Mr. Sexton's own actions that brought both him, my client, and other people to the ground. So, there's no doubt whatsoever, that's almost akin to DNA evidence, that Mr. Sexton was a liar. Well, Mr. Sexton was buddies with the other two, and they all get together on the same day and make false statements against my client. I think that is sufficient to say that there was a lack of probable cause. I don't believe that any reasonable person could believe these three individuals in their accusations.
Well, the reason I asked to frame the question, we're not dealing with a fully developed record of probable cause, et cetera. The question is whether this warrant was supported by probable cause, and if there are any misstatements in that taken out would leave probable cause. And there's an awful lot left in here after you pull away your characterizations of these other arguments. My boss told me to do it. Certainly, for example, doesn't necessarily take away much of anything. If anything, it might reinforce it. So you've thrown a lot of things in there, and I appreciate that, but I think we have to zero in on the things that were arguably material. Taking those away, you can take away some material facts that are material and not relevant in that sense, but the question is the residual, what's left when you take those away in the Franks delegation.
If you look at
that's why Franks sets a high standard so that you don't have people who issued warrants and the intermediaries are not called to task for retrials later of probable cause issue.
It is, but in this case, there's a whole lot of exculpatory evidence, including inconsistent statements made by the accusers. And there's precedent from this, because when you're correcting the affidavit, it's not just excluding the false statements, it's excluding the false statements and adding in the missing or omitted exculpatory information. So when you put that back in, it shows the inconsistencies between the three accusers, which is what was critical in overturning the summary judgment in Winter v. Rogers. It was critical in the Fifth Circuit's finding in Hale v.
I keep going back to it. It's not a question of an officer arrested the man for what he did. You have an intermediary, pursuant to the warrant clause, that protects a citizen from unlawful arrest. And if you got arrested with a warrant, you insist you got to have a warrant. Well, that's why we have an intermediary. And the question is, when that intermediary is there, is there material evidence before them? And what you're doing is really putting to retry all those other facts to say that it wasn't.
But that's what Frank says. Frank says that if the intermediary is tricked and duped, then the warrant's not valid. And that's what I believe occurred in this case. The intermediary was duped. And it's an interesting fact about the intermediary doctrine. It's maybe not directly my point. This case, with all the facts presented to a grand jury, state grand jury.
Stop you there, Mr. Venezia, because you're shifting to another point. But you've reserved your rebuttal time to come back up. So we have your opening argument, so let's hear from Ms. Gudo, and you've got your 5 minutes intact. Okay. All right. Ms. Gudo.
Good morning. Renee Gudo on behalf of the City of New Orleans and Sergeant Corey Limus.
I need your theater voice.
Yes, Your Honor. The city filed a Rule 12 motion to dismiss, asserting that plaintiff's allegations regarding the alleged omissions and false statement do not negate probable cause for his arrest. Therefore, his Fourth Amendment claim fails as a matter of law. The district court agreed with the city, finding that plaintiff failed to demonstrate that probable cause was lacking for any of the three crimes for which he was arrested. In making this finding, the district court reviewed the sufficiency of Sergeant Limus's affidavit by analyzing plaintiff's allegations regarding the alleged omissions and false statement in conjunction with the entire affidavit in order to determine probable cause. The district court properly determined that the affidavit contained ample evidence from independent sources to support a finding of probable cause, even considering plaintiff's alleged omissions and false statement. Therefore, plaintiff's Fourth Amendment claim failed. Plaintiff has filed this appeal and asserts a series of omissions are fatal to the affidavit. Those mainly concern the reliability and credibility of the juveniles in this instance. Plaintiff first points to the juvenile's criminal and violent history, stating that should have been included, as he mentioned today. In the same vein, plaintiff has claimed that his and the other staff members' lack of violent criminal history should have been included. Plaintiff also alleged this broad conspiracy claim between the juveniles, claiming that they are known associates of one another who each made false statements to seek revenge or retribution against the plaintiff. Fifth Circuit precedent dictates that victim eyewitnesses are considered reliable reporters absent a clear motive to lie. In fact, victim eyewitnesses' reliability does not need to be proven. Mr. Venezia cited Hale v. Fish, where it found the exception where the victim eyewitnesses were being prosecuted by the DA's office that was subject to a criminal inquiry leading to the plaintiff's arrest. I will note that in Hale v. Fish, they did note that there was some questions regarding the reliability, but the court ultimately determined that the affidavit contained ample evidence from other independent sources to support a finding of probable cause. I want to note that the issue in this case is about juvenile victims with pending delinquency charges who are reporting misconduct by Youth Study Center staff. And as this court noted, the district court cited four important points in their ruling regarding these issues, the first of which is that the district court noted that the criminal histories of the juveniles could have been inferred by their detainment at the Youth Study Center. Also, that their prior conduct does not preclude them from being victims of a crime, nor does it automatically render their statements as untrue. The district court readily distinguished Hale and also determined that the motive to lie asserted by the plaintiff is highly speculative and misplaced in the context of the arrest warrant. As I noted in my reply with the district court, is that there is no indication that the juveniles were being prosecuted for these alleged violent acts against others or the attempted escape. Therefore, Mr. Thornton would never have been called as a witness to any sort of criminal proceedings related to that. It's just a highly speculative claim. Furthermore, any credibility issues are undermined by the numerous sources of independent evidence that was cited in the affidavit. I want to note that this affidavit is a four-page, single-spaced affidavit, and it provides a detailed account of his review of multiple sources in connection with the three incidents. This includes the incident reports, the forensic interviews with the juveniles, the medical records. The medical records and specifically indicated that Kylie Sexton suffered a concussion. The video footage and also Sergeant Limas' own observation of the injuries. Thus, the district court properly found that the affidavit contained ample evidence from independent sources to support a finding of probable cause, even considering the credibility issues that are implied by the plaintiff. Plaintiff also alleges that Sergeant Limas intentionally excluded that the source of HT's injuries was regarding his fight with another detainee rather than the plaintiff. In making this assertion, plaintiff inappropriately suggests that Sergeant Limas should have made a medical and causation determination of his injuries in his affidavit. I will note that the fight between HT and the other detainee was documented on page 3 of the affidavit. Plaintiff also alleges that Sergeant Limas omitted other facts from the video and medical records that show that Kylie Sexton's injuries were false, as he stated today. The district court noted that plaintiff failed to identify any facts which show beyond a doubt that Kylie Sexton's accusations were false. I'll note that the affidavit indicates that the video footage is only available of the common area, that there is no video footage available from the interior of the juvenile cells. Next, in terms of the medical records, it's clear that Kylie Sexton suffered a concussion. It's unclear what facts would show beyond a doubt that Kylie Sexton was lying in this instance. As noted today, plaintiff has made one last attempt at salvaging his omission claim by citing Winfrey v. Rogers. In Winfrey, the omitted information from an arrest affidavit include physical evidence. It was actually a scent lineup which did not implicate the arrestee, and it also failed to include potentially exculpatory witness statements. This court found that the affidavit in that instance was not sufficient and did not contain sufficient information to establish probable cause. Plaintiff's reliance on Winfrey is clearly misplaced. This case is readily distinguishable. Sergeant Limas included all of the exculpatory material in his affidavit. This includes the plaintiff's own statements regarding that he did not use excessive force or profane language. That's on page 4 of the affidavit. Sergeant Limas also included statements from the other Youth Studies Center staff by name and by their position at the Youth Studies Center, and they all indicated that he did not use excessive force or profane language. Sergeant Limas relayed what he observed on the video footage, as well as noting that the video footage was not available from the interior of the cells, and he also documented the fight between HT and the other juvenile. Therefore, it's clear that the affidavit doesn't lack probable cause, even considering plaintiff's omissions. In terms of the false statement, plaintiff claims that Sergeant Limas falsely stated that the video of the incident shows that one of plaintiff's movement was consistent with a jab punch. Bueller versus the City of Austin, Anderson versus City of Macomb has shown that actions that are subject to different interpretations are not the false statements that are to be considered under Franks. The district court correctly cited Bueller and Anderson to find that the alleged false statement merely reflects what Sergeant Limas's interpretation of what he saw on the video and does not represent the kind of knowing and intentional false statement that is required. Nevertheless, the district court found that probable cause existed absent the jab punch statement, specifically because it does reference the independent sources of the evidence, which include the incident reports, the forensic interviews, medical records, video footage, and his own observation of the injuries. Thornton's argument that the inclusion of the alleged false statement and exclusion of the exculpatory evidence would negate probable cause for his arrest fails as a matter of law, and the district court correctly determined that he failed to sufficiently plead a Fourth Amendment violation. I'll note that the court concluded that there was not a violation, therefore it did not address whether Sergeant Limas was entitled to qualified immunity on the same claim. This issue was raised on appeal, so I'll just briefly address that issue of whether or not Sergeant Limas's conduct was objectively reasonable. The Supreme Court has held that law enforcement officials who reasonably but mistakenly conclude that probable cause is present are entitled to qualified immunity. Plaintiff doesn't claim that the omissions or statements were the product of a deliberate falsehood or reckless disregard for the truth, nor does he indicate that other officers would have included or excluded this information from an arrest affidavit. In conclusion, the district court properly granted the city's motion to dismiss because the plaintiff failed to allege a Fourth Amendment claim. It's clear that the alleged omissions and false statement have little to no bearing on the determination of probable cause in this particular instance. The appellees pray that this court affirm the district court's ruling. I'm happy to answer any questions regarding.
Thank you. I think we have your argument.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. All right, back to you, Mr. Venezia. You have any rebuttal?
Just very briefly, Your Honor. There was another intermediary that reviewed this matter. The district attorney, the state district attorney, took this case, including both the inculpatory and exculpatory information, presented it to a grand jury. The grand jury returned a no true bill. That's not dispositive, but it should be given just as much weight as the lower court's finding that there was probable cause. Had he been indicted by the grand jury, we wouldn't be here right now because that would have been sufficient as a matter of law to establish probable cause. He couldn't even question it in the state court proceedings with a preliminary examination because the finding would have been, he would have been held to it. It would be nothing more that he could do about it. He's in a situation where that went favorable for him. The proceeding that he didn't participate in was resolved in his favor because the full story was told to them. I don't believe that the full story establishes probable cause. I think the full story, as outlined in our complaint, including all the omitted exculpatory evidence, shows that it is not reasonable to believe that what these three accusers said about my client and that he should never have been arrested. I think that his case is similar to the Hale v. Fish case. I think it's similar to the Sanders v. English case, and I think it's similar to the Winfrey versus Rogers case. In all of those cases, there was exculpatory evidence that was exempted or not included in an affidavit, and either this court overturned a summary judgment grant in favor of the defendant or affirmed a trial court verdict in favor of the plaintiff. So I believe that Your Honor should reverse the lower court's decision.
All right, thank you, Mr. Venezia. Appreciate your briefing and argument. Same you, Ms. Goodall. That concludes the argument in this case. It'll be submitted, and that concludes the oral arguments for the panel for today. We will resume tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. In the meantime, we stand adjourned for today.